Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, the United National Anti-War Coalition calls for reparations for victims of the transatlantic slave trade. The United States and its allies try to do to Syria what they did to Libya, and opposition from the left and the right to preventive detention. But first, Occupy Wall Street held demonstrations in more than a dozen cities to denounce torture in prison and the system of mass incarceration. At New York's Riverside Church, hundreds heard activist Carl Dix make the case that mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. Dix is a leader of the Stop, Stop and Frisk campaign in New York.
New York Police Department Chief Ray Kelly constantly says that racist illegal policies like Stop and Frisk are needed to fight crime and get guns off the street. These are bald-faced lies, sisters and brothers. Even the figures put out by the New York Police Department, NYPD, show that they're lies. Now, I've challenged Kelly to meet me in a debate over Stop and Frisk, and I renew that challenge today. Ray Kelly, get your ass out here. Meet me up in Harlem. And let's talk about Stop and Frisk. Let's do it in front of an audience of the people that your cops inflict terror on up here. Let's get into what's really behind this brutality that your pigs enforce on people. Stop hiding in TV studios telling your good friends in the media that your cops are trying to keep people safe and combat crime. Because we know it's lies, and we can prove it's lies. Come on out here and talk about it. Because look, today you've got laws to target black people. You got police departments unleashed to harass, brutalize, and even murder people with impunity in the inner cities. You got a criminal justice system that focuses its law enforcement in black and Latino communities and discriminates against black and blacks and Latinos who get caught up in the courts. You have the way the death penalty falls heaviest on blacks and Latinos, including in cases where people were convicted based on made-up evidence, like Troy Davis, who the state of Georgia executed last September, and like Mumia Abu-Jamal. They ain't got this brother yet, and we have to make sure they don't. His death sentence has been overturned, and in recent days, he's gotten off death row, but he remains in jail facing a sentence of life without parole, and that's unjust, too, because his brother was framed up. Now, the system justifies all this by demonizing the youth and spreading the lie that the masses are to blame for what the system does to them. Today, this has gotten to the point where the ability of large sections of black people to survive is seriously threatened. What all this adds up to is a group of people who have been identified, who have been demonized. Now, confiscation hasn't gone down in the same way that it did in Nazi Germany, because in Germany, the Nazis took the property of Jewish people before they shipped them off to the concentration camps, to the death camps. But historically, this system has stolen the fruits of labor of black people through slavery and continued to do so after slavery had been abolished. And you've got people who have been concentrated in the worst urban areas, in the most rundown schools, and in the prisons. Now, I'm not saying that things are going to end up as an all-out genocide, or here's how it's going to happen. A big part of that depends on you and me. It depends on what we do and what we don't do. Whether we respond to this with silence and passivity in the face of these horrendous attacks, or take up the challenge and wage determined resistance against all this. What I'm saying, though, is that we have to look at how things are developing. In the Republican campaign for president, they introduced Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, by saying he had executed more people than any other governor in U.S. history. And the crowd cheered. They cheered. The same crowd chanted, "Let them die," when the talk turned to, "What do you do about people who get sick but don't have any health insurance?" You got that puffed-up racist Newt Gingrich. He says the problem is black youth grow up in a culture that doesn't value work, and that we should fire the school janitors and make the students clean up their own schools. That'll give them a good work ethic, he says. Another Republican candidate, Rick Santorum, said that he wasn't going to take other people's money and give it to black people. Now, the reality is that this system has ruthlessly exploited black people since they dragged the first African to these shores in slave chains. And today, this system is unleashing genocidal attacks as a way of dealing with the fact that they can no longer profitably exploit black people. This reflects the development and promotion of hardcore fascist forces being brought together around a thoroughly reactionary program. Now, these mouthpieces for the capitalist system spout this kind of racist rhetoric to tap into and promote the white supremacy that's built into the very fabric of this society. They say that black people are inferior to whites and that they're the cause of the problems society faces. Their aim is to get whites to support the way the authorities clamp down on black people. You can trace this approach back to the founding fathers. Slave owners among them, like Thomas Jefferson, relied very heavily on patrollers or paddy rollers, coming off the fact that a lot of them were of Irish background, who were largely poor whites, to help them keep slaves in line. This continues down to today, but it's been given a new twist. Today they talk about how racial discrimination, hey, that's a thing of the past. This is now a post-racial society. It's even got a black president. So there's no longer any reason for black people to talk about injustice, and that any problems they face today has just got to be their own damn fault. Okay, now, at the same time, you got Obama, who serves the same system. He took over the White House from Bush, and he's continued many of Bush's policies, including the warehousing of our youth in prison. But I could also add to that wars for empire, government spying, stripping away of people's rights. See, and let's get local for a minute, because I remember Obama telling us in 2007 that we had to accept the verdict of the courts in the Sean Bell case, exonerating the police who had murdered that brother in a hail of 50 shots. But we had to accept that. I also remember, because I heard some of them, the Father's Day speeches that he gives, where he says that absent dads are the reason why black youth face the horrible conditions that they're up against. But you notice when he gives those talks, he never says, well, where are those absent dads? Well, I'll tell you where they are. A lot of them are being warehoused in the prisons across this country, and they're there because this system has criminalized black people. That's what's going down there. Now look, I know a lot of people got swept up into getting behind Obama in the last election. I ain't mad at you about that. Some people even told me that they had made their revolution by putting Obama into office. But what that really accomplished was disarming people in the face of this all-out onslaught. Now, when I say this adds up to a slow genocide that could become a fast one, I know some people might be thinking, okay, Carl, you're talking about what's a very terrible problem, but aren't you going too far to call it a genocide? No, I am not. I'm calling it what it is. When people hear the term genocide, they think of Nazi Germany and what was done to the Jewish people there. Rounded up, forced into ghettos, shipped to concentration camps, where every day thousands were murdered. See, now that was the final step of that genocide. But that's not where it started. And it's not the only form that genocide can take. How did it begin? Germany was mired in an economic, political, and social crisis. Adolf Hitler and his Nazis rallied dissatisfied sections of people, telling them that true Germans were superior and that Jews were animals. that Jews, along with the communist and other non-German groups, were the cause of society's problems. Does any of that sound familiar? It should. The Nazis were put into power. The media, culture, and educational systems stepped up demonizing the Jews. Mobs were rallied to attack them. See, and here's a key part of this. There were Germans who opposed these things, but they failed to stand up, to call them out for what they were, and to manifest the necessary determined resistance. There was too much silence in the face of this. Things didn't start out with the death camps. Instead, they went step by step and through phases. And the logic of what was being done and what was used to justify what was being done led to the death camps. Not only that, genocide isn't just when mass murder is committed, because it's a process. It can be when a group of people is targeted in ways that confine large sections of them to prison or hold them down in suppressive conditions that threaten their survival, even if it happens in phases, even if it looks like it's occurring just through the normal workings of things or because of policy decisions by the government that are explained and justified for other reasons. This is the way things are headed in this country. This is not about some prison industry trying to make profit off of the suffering of black and other oppressed people, although that is in there. This is about a capitalist imperialist system which never blinked at slavery, never blinked at wiping out whole peoples who got in their way, from the Native Americans to the Vietnamese to the Iraqis, a system that never blinked at experimenting on people of color. And if you think I'm lying, Google Tuskegee 626, and you'll get an example of it. Or look at some things that happened more recently in Guatemala to get another example of what this system will do. I'm talking about a system that lives off the blood and flesh of little children and teenagers who work in their factories all over the world, feeding into their wealth. This is about a major policy of the rulers of this system with a definite logic to it. That logic could not only take things further in a genocidal direction, but it could greatly accelerate the pace of that direction if it isn't stopped. All of this is why I say the conditions being enforced on the black masses today come down to a slow genocide that could easily become a fast one. Mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide.
Carl Dix at New York's Riverside Church. The preventive detention bill passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama could be an issue that unites activists of the left and right, according to Christina Tobin of the Free and Equal Foundation. Tobin says preventive detention without trial or charge eviscerates the U.S. Constitution.
Our Bill of Rights, you know, essentially are being stripped away by Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. You know, what it does is it authorizes the use of the military force and indefinite detention without trial against anyone. That could be you, me, you know, including United States citizens if we're suspected of hostilities against the United States. This is very frightening.
Without due process, how can one say that the rule of law exists?
We need to point the fingers at the people in office who are allowing this to happen, from President Obama himself, you know, all the way down to legislatures and so on, Congress, who are pushing this through. Really, we need to be looking and seeing, well, are these people representing us, or are they part of the corrupt electoral system? And Free and Equal Elections, you know, is here. You know, as a founder and chair of Free and Equal Elections, you can find us at freeandequal.org. We're here to create that solid grassroots base to unite the left and the right, all taxpayers, all leaders, you know, all organizations, media, grassroots alike, for electoral reform. The people in office that are allowing bills like NDAA 1021 to pass need to be kicked out of office. That's what we need to do.
Now, it's quite clear that the Obama administration helped to shape this preventive detention law. Did you expect that kind of behavior from candidate Obama?
Absolutely. You know, as the National Ballot Access Coordinator for Ralph Nader in 2008, it comes to no surprise that Obama is capable of supporting such a horrible bill in the AA, you know, as well as, you know, members of Congress. What we have here is a corrupt electoral system. If Bush was in office, I would think just as negatively about him as well. This is not about parties. This is about Democrats and Republicans alike that are wrongfully elected for office. They take funding, whether it's from really bad union bosses to corporations. The day they get elected for office and start campaigning for their next election, we need people in office that represent you, me, your listeners, across the political spectrum. And Free and Equal Elections is here to stand and unite and create that movement for electoral reform.
Your organization believes there's a prospect for political unity between members of the Tea Party, the Occupy movement, and libertarians around opposition to preventive detention.
Several years ago in 2009, we held a Tea Party event in the heart of Chicago, Davy Pier, and we had the former campaign manager for Ralph Nader, Teresa Amato. She was a speaker there. A Green Party candidate, Charlie Howe, he was a speaker. Some libertarians. I'm personally an independent. We all united, you know, to bring about transparency and electoral reform. This is what we need. And you can launch our first big event in the heart of Chicago, uniting grassroots Occupy Wall Street, grassroots Tea Party, grassroots media, and organizations across the spectrum for electoral reform. Whether it comes down to NDAA, to war, to marijuana, to GMO, Monsanto, all these different issues, all stem, the problem stems towards the people who are currently in office are allowing this to happen. And we need to kick them, Republicans and Democrats, out of office, and we the people need to run for office.
So far in the presidential campaign, preventive detention has not been an issue. How do you change that?
We need to create a movement once again across the spectrum for electoral reform. The key is running for Congress in 2012. 2014 is going to be the big one. I see a huge movement of people flooding the system across the political spectrum to run for office, and a grassroots movement, you know, with money, not from corporations, not from unions, but people that are there running, you know, to make the United States a better place.
Christina Tobin of the Free and Equal Campaign. In Newark, New Jersey, the People's Organization for Progress, or POP, marks day 247 of its daily demonstrations for jobs, housing, education, peace, and justice. That leaves only 139 days to go to match the duration of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. Dr. Akhil Kalfani is director of the Africana Studies Institute at Essex County College, which is located in Newark. He's spoken at POP rallies.
I think that POP has basically provided kind of a foundation, a context for a continuation of struggle that's going on here in Newark since the 60s, really, and that the problem of transformation from a community where, you know, you have a extremely poor foundation and people having access to jobs and education, that's been an ongoing struggle, even the struggle to have Essex County College in downtown Newark. So this really is a continuation of that. And the need today, though, is to bring a greater awareness, and I think really this is an awareness campaign, trying to get different factions within the larger community active, so to get students active, to get the unions active, but to realize that their activity is only most effective when they are working together, and that they have certain things that are common within them and then certain things that are different, but they have to find strength in their commonality and not always focus on their differences or their own individual uniqueness to the exclusion of building alliances between different organizations.
And, of course, POP is keying these daily demonstrations on the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955. I suppose that's a way of demonstrating that demonstrations and hitting the streets is not passé. It's not something from another era that has no utility today.
Right, and POP hasn't been the only organization to do that. In Newark, you've had the Newark Anti-Violence Coalition that has regular, every Wednesday they have a rally at a different place to stop violence in the city. The New Black Panther Party has held rallies, and the unions have held rallies, all independent of POP's initiatives, but that POP has built a coalition of over 100, 150 organizations. And so getting a bunch of different organizations to understand their collective value, I think, is the benefit of POP in particular in their effort. When we look at that, then we come to understanding that it does resonate even in today's society.
Newark has been a black administered city since 1970. Of course, Montgomery, Alabama occurred in the Jim Crow South, where black folks didn't have elementary citizenship rights. But the same tactics still obtain.
Yes, I mean, I think that they do apply because it's not just a tactic that's being used to government. At this point, I think more so it's an awareness campaign amongst the citizenry as opposed to an attack on government. Some of the marches have been led down towards City Hall or to different corporate entities. But that if it was strictly an attack on government, then I would assume that the daily rally would be outside City Hall. So since that's not the location, then I don't think that that's the point. The point is that this is a cross-section of people on West Market, Springfield, and South Orange Avenue, a major, and University Avenue, so a major thoroughfare throughout the heart of Newark, and trying to get as many people to see that they need to do something as possible, trying to get people to wake up, to understand that there still are issues going on, that we need to be vigilant about our efforts to address issues of the housing situation going on in Newark and elsewhere in America, the issues about the jobs in the United States, the issues about the ever rising college tuitions, issues about wars. And so that bringing these three things together has been important. But also one of the interesting nuances of what this rally that they've been doing is that they've also created a space where different organizations who signed on to be co-sponsors can also take on a day to bring out their own specific issues in addition to those that are related to the core principles that POP has done this for.
I'm told that nearly 200 organizations have signed on in that regard, with varying degrees of participation on the street. Do you find that impressive?
I think it is an important milestone. Whether or not it's impressive is to whether or not those organizations actually take steps to move beyond putting their name on something and actually doing something. And I think that's the next level. Take a look back at what happened with the anti-apartheid movement and the divestment movement, that level of protesting and rallying galvanized a wide variety of folks to actually do something to force large corporations and educational institutions to pull all their retirement and investment monies out of South African companies, and that had a major impact. You know, maybe we need to really think about that whole issue. Maybe there's a divestment component that should be attached to this, so that those companies and educational institutions that are causing the harm or the pain that folks are feeling, that in fact that they begin to feel it in a different way. And so that's how we, you know, may need to rethink the whole contextualization of this issue.
And you're at Essex County College. Many of the students, of course, there are adults. But what do you think about the level of student involvement, not just with POP's demonstrations, but with political activity in general?
The way I see it is that on college campuses across the U.S., I think that the students have shown a fair amount of apathy is what we've seen. We haven't seen a sustained effort that students have been involved in. I think that, unfortunately, students haven't found that there's a need to. They see that they're not sitting on the back of a bus. No one's telling them what water fountain they can or cannot drink out of. And so some of the oppressions that they experience are masked. And until they feel them firsthand, they don't do anything about them. And when they feel them firsthand, they oftentimes are no longer in school, or they're somewhere out and they're on their own, and they don't have the power of their 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 student body force to be able to galvanize that type of momentum that they had in their hands when they were students.
Dr. Akhil Kulkarni, speaking from Newark, New Jersey. The United States and its allies in Europe and the Persian Gulf have their sights set on overthrowing the government in Syria. We spoke with Dr. Francis Boyle, the renowned professor of international law, and asked if the U.S. is attempting to work the same regime change formula in Syria as it did in Libya last year.
That's correct. During the Bush Jr. administration, the neoconservative Zionists publicly bragged and boasted that Syria was low-hanging fruit, meaning they could go in there and take it quite easily. But in fact, Libya was the lower-hanging fruit. You know, I had spent a lot of time in Libya, and it was clear, with all due respect to the Libyans, they were sitting on this tremendous deposit of oil and gas, but could barely defend themselves. And it's simply amazing to me that Gaddafi could hold out for 8 months trying to defend Libya and his people against the most awesome military power in the history of the world, NATO and the United States. But finally, Gaddafi succumbed, and that was ripe for the pickings, as they saw it. So now the neoconservatives and all the rest of them, they're moving on to Syria. So this has been in the works for quite some time, and it's the same agenda they pursued towards Libya. They failed to get a Security Council resolution that could have been used as sort of a legal fig leaf and pretext for military action against Syria. The Russians and the Chinese vetoed it. And so they took the resolution at the Security Council, got it adopted by the General Assembly, and I guess we'll try to use that as some type of justification for some type of overt military intervention into Syria. It's clear there's already covert intervention now. It's already been reported by Israeli and other sources that the British, Qatari, probably French, for all we know, Americans have special forces in there, probably Turks too. It's already underway.
The U.S. and its allies insist that Syria doesn't have a right to protect itself. Now, about one-third of the deaths in this internal conflict have already been Syrian soldiers and policemen. Clearly, it is an armed conflict.
Obviously, my guess is, like what happened in Libya, there was a spontaneous protest and demonstrations by people living there against the Assad government. That doesn't surprise me at all. But it was quickly hijacked and has been used as a pretext to promote an attempt to overthrow the Assad government. And if that doesn't work, to produce civil war in Syria that would neutralize Syria and its longstanding refusal to succumb to Israel's demands and the Zionist demands that they effectively give up the Golan Heights, and also to crack Syria up into its ethnic components, which it does have, along the lines of what they've already done to Afghanistan, Iraq, Yugoslavia, and Libya, too. So the same thing could very well happen to Syria. And it will simply serve the interests of Israel, the United States, France, the former colonial power there. It's a joke and a fraud to say that France is least bit interested in human rights in Syria. And also Turkey, the other former colonial power in Syria. And again, it's a joke and a fraud to say that Turkey's the least bit interested in human rights in Syria, especially after what it's done to its and is still doing to its own Kurdish people in Turkey itself and also in northern Iraq. So you really can't take these colonial imperial powers seriously when they shed crocodile tears for human rights.
France is demanding a humanitarian corridor in Syria. But, of course, we remember that NATO rejected the idea of a humanitarian corridor in Libya when the African Union proposed one.
Look at the proposal by the African Union, which is the appropriate regional organization set up under Chapter 8 of the United Nations Charter to deal with Africa. And they had a very comprehensive peace proposal there for Libya, and it was completely brushed aside and indeed stymied at the Security Council and the General Assembly. So the colonial imperial powers in NATO and the United States paid absolutely no attention at all to the African Union. This is all eyewash that they're concerned about human rights. I mean, have any of them lifted one finger at all to help the Palestinians, especially the 1.5 million Palestinians now being subjected to slow-motion genocide in Gaza? Of course not. So it's just preposterous. This is all propaganda here in the United States that I don't think really deceives anyone over there in the region about what's really going on.
It seems to many of us that Syria has been forced to battle block by block in certain cities, lest the West declare some area, some city, some border area, some sliver of land in Syria to be a kind of liberated territory that must be protected by the West.
Well, they did the same thing in Libya in Benghazi, right? Remember, Reagan tried to do the same thing in Nicaragua with the Contras and set up some type of free zone and a liberated government that could then ask for military intervention. That is correct. So this is pretty much par for the course for these colonial imperial powers, right?
Now, as an expert on international law, is Syria within its rights to defend its control over all of its territory?
Well, I'm not justifying any human rights violations by Syria one way or the other, but certainly it seems to me that what is going on here is an organized attempt to overthrow the legitimate government of Syria that is being coordinated by the United States, France, Turkey, Qatar, a dictatorship, and Saudi Arabia, another dictatorship. And it appears support coming from Israel in Iraq and other forces under the control of Western intelligence agencies such as al-Qaeda. For example, last week, the Financial Times reported that all these al-Qaeda fighters are, after they did the dirty work in Libya, are now moving over to mobilize to be used against Syria. Also, they are mobilizing now in Jordan as we speak. The government does have a right to keep itself in power. You know, who gives Obama the right to say that the government in Syria should step down? None. But they don't really care. There has been no effort made at all by the United States, any of these imperial powers, or by the United Nations or the League of Arab States to achieve a peaceful resolution of this dispute as required by the terms of the United Nations Charter under Chapter 6, which is what they should have done before moving to Chapter 7 enforcement measures. No effort at all has been made to produce a peaceful resolution of this matter, and that's exactly what happened in Libya. No effort at all was made. So I think that indicates just an absence of good faith. And at this point, they have no intention of a peaceful resolution of this dispute. Their intention, their objective, is to overthrow the Assad government, put in a stooge puppet, if possible, that will be under the control of the United States, France, and at the end of the day, sign some type of bogus peace treaty with Israel that will give them the control of the Golan Heights. Indeed, Netanyahu himself has publicly stated Israel, as he put it, is not going to come down from the Golan Heights. So I think that agenda is pretty clear.
And what of the posture of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch?
Yeah, all these human rights organizations are simply mongering for war. I just got an email from Amnesty International. You know, I used to be on the board of directors of Amnesty International USA for 4 years. I know how they work quite clearly. I just got an email from them, Amnesty International, saying, when is the world going to do something about Syria? So it's clear they are mongering for war and military intervention. Indeed, Amnesty International USA just hired one of Mrs. Clinton's top advisors to run Amnesty International USA. So what do you think she's doing but mobilizing Amnesty International USA? And then because of their control or influence of the budget over London, I'm sure we'll see Amnesty International itself worldwide mongering for war against Syria, just as they did against Libya.
And what of the behavior of the U.S. news media in this conflict?
Look at CNN. That's just appalling. We know Anderson Cooper worked for the CIA. Once CIA, always CIA. And their resident expert on the Middle East is Fuad Ajami, who is the token Arab neocon and a total fraud when it comes to the Middle East. I've known him personally for many years. He's a complete and total fraud. And he just gets on there and mongers for war every night. And he did the same thing with Libya. CNN knows exactly what they're doing. These so-called reports about this Syrian observatory, well, they're headquartered in London, and the Free Forces, their head is in Paris. So all these people are pretty much a collection of exiles under the control of U.S., Britain, France, and all mongering for war. They very well might get it because the message is simply not getting out. And unfortunately, people are not seeing it's the same agenda on Libya that the neocons and the Zionists are repeating against Syria. But the major difference is that Syria, unlike Libya, is very well armed, equipped, and supplied. As I said, I was amazed that Gaddafi could hold out for the 8 months, sort of like a Hannibal of his generation. Whereas the Assad government does have a very powerful military force, this whole situation could become extremely violent. And the Russians have sent sort of a naval task force there to the Syrian port of Tartus, where they are sitting basically to deter a NATO attack. And the U.S. government also has an aircraft carrier strike force there in the Mediterranean off the coast of Syria. So it's an extremely volatile and dangerous situation.
Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois at Champaign. The United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, holds a major conference in Stamford, Connecticut, March 23rd. UNAC's 12-point program of action denounces the imperial 1% for waging wars at home and abroad. Spokesperson Chris Gavreau.
We're in fact responding to our understanding, our deeper understanding of just what the U.S. government and its allies are up to. While I've organized previous conventions that have focused primarily on boots-on-the-ground wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, wars which continue in various ways in both countries, it's very clear that if we're to meet the challenge of confronting the new war budget of the Obama administration and the new strategic plans of Washington, that we have to organize to confront drone war, special ops, preparations for war in most of the theaters of the world. The new strategic plans as outlined by the Pentagon include great new attention, new nefarious deeds all over the continent of Africa, a real expansion of the so-called war on terror on the African continent. It includes the so-called return to Asia, in which the U.S. is really saber-rattling against China, taking sides in disputes in the South China Sea over oil-rich swaths of the sea and islands disputes that should be left up to the people of Asia to resolve. And there is no way for us to actually mobilize the majority of the people in the U.S. against these money-sucking adventures than to educate them broadly about what the U.S. is up to.
And you put forward 12 points, which cover basically all the theaters of war, but also makes a very general statement, I think a profound one. You call for compensation and reparations to the peoples of the world whose countries the U.S. has attacked and destroyed and occupied and impoverished, and to the victims of the transatlantic slave trade.
I think many in the anti-war movement are quite familiar with the demand for reparations for Iraq, a country whose entire infrastructure we have destroyed and failed to rebuild in this entire decade of war. And that's a familiar demand. Perhaps the demand for reparations for the victims of the transatlantic slave trade is a new one for the anti-war movement, but it shouldn't be. Part of what we hope to do at this conference in March is to knit real bonds of solidarity between the victims of the war at home on the black community and all those fighting the wars abroad. We're going to do that first by holding a major plenary session at lunch on the war at home on the black community, featuring expert scholars and leading activists on the devastating impact of mass incarceration, stop and frisk, and other attacks on the black community, all of which up to this point have been designed to demobilize the black community, to rip them out of the struggle for social change in the U.S., and we want to confront that head on. And there is no more fundamental or just demand that's emanated from the black community in the last 40 or 50 years of struggle than the question of reparations.
And point number 11 has profound ramifications domestically. You call for shutting down the military-industrial complex and the biological and chemical warfare complex.
Every study shows that war spending produces fewer jobs than investment in almost every other sector. Right now, we're facing a situation with millions unemployed. We have to demand that all those government funds taken from working people and taxes actually are invested to promote the kinds of industries that are for the health and well-being and advancement and financial security and mental health of working people in this country. We are seeing such an incredible expansion of the military-industrial complex. Perhaps one of the most Orwellian aspects of it is the huge new production of drones, which are being used on the U.S. borders, tested in Wyoming, and planned to be part of law enforcement of our major cities in the next decade. We have to highlight this production going on in the U.S. We have to win the American people to understand that some industrial development, some technology advancement are only going to harm the social progress and the future well-being, not only of people of the world, but of working people here in the U.S. struggling for a decent life.
UNAC is calling for an end to all threats of war and intervention against Iran and against Syria. You call for no sanctions, no blockades, and no embargoes. But a lot of the left, or what passes for the left in the United States, seems quite ambivalent on this subject.
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of confusion, and we see that large layers of what might be called the progressive movement retains a lot of illusions in the idea that the U.S., the U.N., and other forces dominated by the U.S. and the major European powers could actually carry out a so-called humanitarian mission. But Iraq, Libya, just for two examples, shows us very clearly that any intervention, no matter what your view of what's happening on the ground in these countries, I think we can and must win the anti-war movement to the understanding that any intervention by the U.S. or U.N. forces under their hegemony, basically, will not result in any increase in democracy, self-determination, or sovereignty in these countries. Libya proves that absolutely. For for all the hoopla about defending a fight for democracy in that country, what the regime that's been put into place is indisputably, and most human rights advocates agree with this, a regime that is a bunch of thugs continuing to carry out pogroms against black Libyans and supporters of the previous regime, the exact opposite of the sort of society that most Americans would hope that their government supports.
UNAC calls for an end to U.S. aid to dictators everywhere and hands off the Arab Spring. From UNAC's standpoint, what has been the United States' response to the Arab Spring?
Well, it's been a relatively sophisticated one, I guess you might say. The U.S. purports to support greater democracy in the Middle East, in the nations that have since World War II basically been run by oil oligarchies subservient to the U.S. on a military and political plane. But in truth, we can see that their actual response, of course, was to support Mubarak as long as they could in Egypt to prop up the armed forces as the ruling elite. Subsequent to that, in order to prevent the revolutionary upsurge in Egypt from going in the direction demanded by the unionists, independent unionists, and large student movement and movement of the underemployed, going in a direction of greater equality and social justice, the U.S. has been pouring billions into a fund. I believe it's just called the Directed Investment Fund. Billions that are designed to prop up pro-capitalist elements and initiatives in the region that could head off any genuine people's solution to the neoliberal crisis that's weighing down on the masses in the Arab world.
What effect has the advent of the Occupy Wall Street movement had on attempts to resuscitate the U.S. anti-war movement?
The Occupy movement has been a breath of fresh air. I think it's inspired all of us to understand that a whole generation of youth is willing to fight for social justice. In Chicago, for example, where the anti-war movement hopes to mount a powerful demonstration in the streets against the NATO G8 summit, that work, that huge fight for civil liberties, the fight for mobilization, the fight to politically explain what NATO and the G8 summit is all about has been really embraced by Occupy Chicago and the inter-Occupy groups formation nationally, who will be encouraging people to go to Chicago on March 12th for a CanGate-sponsored People's Summit to stay for the large march on May 19th. And I will say that their involvement is, of course, also spurring great international interest in contributing to an important mobilization on that date.
And then on to Stamford, Connecticut on March 23rd.
Absolutely, and we'll be holding over 40 workshops, many of which will bring together activists from Occupy, activists from the traditional anti-war movement, militants like those who mobilized to defend the longshore workers from Longview, Washington, in their battle with EGT, bringing together activists from the Filipino, South Asian, Colombian, Honduran diaspora to bring their solidarity experience into the mix. There's going to be a synergy in Stamford that will be special, that will be part of steeling ourselves for the important struggle ahead.
That was Chris Gavreau of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Activists in Michigan are confident they've gathered enough petitions to put a referendum on the ballot in November to abolish Public Act 4. That's the law that allows the governor to appoint so-called emergency managers to replace elected officials in the state. Emergency managers, or EMs, have seized power in the Detroit public schools and in four cities, including the mostly black town of Benton Harbor. Community leader Reverend Edward Pinckney says the governor's emergency manager is doing the bidding of the Whirlpool Corporation, which is headquartered in Benton Harbor, and had long sought to turn public land over to a luxury golf course. Reverend Pinckney says the people of Benton Harbor have lost their citizenship rights under the rule of the state's emergency manager.
It gave him absolute power. Matter of fact, it gave him so much power that he felt that he can break the Constitution. He can do whatever he wants. In the city of Benton Harbor, his first order was to move the mayor's desk from his office and put it in the basement. Yeah, that's the first thing he did. Matter of fact, he ordered the people that was working for the mayor to take the mayor's desk and take it to the basement. And they did it. Then he ordered the commissioners to turn in their cell phones. Well, that was quite a shock. Now they decided that we was gonna fight them. You know, we need the cell phone in order to communicate with the public, with the people. But no, he said turn them in, or he was gonna go and talk to the governor about having you removed as a commissioner. He also has that power. He can have you, even though you're elected by the people, he can have you removed as a commissioner. This guy was so bold and so strong, he said if he voted for something and everybody in the city of Benton Harbor voted against him, he wins. Not only am I the police chief, I'm the fire chief. He said, I'm the accounting department. I'm the payroll department. He said, I'm public works. I'm everything. He said, there's nothing I am not. He said that anything that goes on in this city goes through me. He said, commissioners, I'm going to let y'all have a meeting. Then I'm going to let you take minutes. Then I'm going to let you adjourn. You can't vote on nothing. Don't even think about voting on anything. He said, I don't even want to hear that you have voted. Matter of fact, what they did, they voted on something, and he got angry. And he told them, I need y'all keys to the office now. They wouldn't give him the keys to the office, so he changed the locks. They can't even go to City Hall. They can't. They don't have an office there. They don't have anything there. Nothing. Because this guy, Joseph Harris, the EM, have came in and told them what they can do. And he's arrogant as he can get. If you ever saw a dictator before, he's one. You should come and take a picture of him. That way you can put him on your dress and say, here's a dictator right here. He know what he's doing. He know exactly what he's doing. Antagonizing the people. I mean, he'll tell you in a minute, the water bill in the city of Benton Harbor have tripled. Every single job that the city employees worked on has been outsourced. Nothing. They only got about maybe 14, 15 police officers in the whole city. And then they have to be firemen. They're firemen and police officers. They merged them together. You wouldn't believe who they got working. We had the snow just recently. They had to outsource that because they done got rid of everybody. Nothing is left. This guy have went beyond the call of duty. Even today, they can't even elect the pro tem. The pro tem had to be elected by the emergency manager, a non-elected official. He had to put this girl in office and say, you the pro tem. You can't vote on them. You can't vote on nothing in this city. Anything in this city that need a vote comes through me. I make that decision. And if all y'all voted against me, and I voted yes, is yes. He was telling everybody the reason why you should have an EM is because look at Benton Harbor. Just recently, they found out that we're in worse shape now than when he came. We're in worse shape right now than we ever been. But they got their golf course. They got the PGA coming here. They got all the things that they need. We used to have over 20,000 people living in Benton Harbor. Now we got less than 10,000 people. They're driving all the people away. They know what they're doing. We have to say enough is enough. What he just did recently is almost unheard of. He put our radio station on eBay. He put the radio station on eBay, including the FCC license, which is illegal. You got to get permission. You can't sell FCC license without getting permission from the FCC. But he got this dictatorship in his mind that he's in control of everything, that forget about FCC. They ain't going to do nothing, but they sent him a letter. And he took the radio station off. Now what he's trying to do, he's trying to figure out a way how to get around this. But this is just the beginning. This is what those EMs does. He's not for the people. He's for these corporations that come in and suck the life out of the people. That's what he do. He comes in and he tried to sell everything that's sellable. Selling lots, the Cornerstone Alliance, which is a subdivision of Whirlpool, for $1, which is worth over $10,000. The EM, he's got to go.
And that's it for this week's edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.